Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today we are exploring music written to showcase the highest level of performance achievement, otherwise known as virtuosity, which sounds a lot nicer than show-off music. But as we've seen, it's more than just glorification of the performer. It's an element of musical compositions that keep the audience engaged when the music or the performance itself might not otherwise. This was particularly important in the Romantic era, in the 19th century basically, where the audience was comprised of the hard-working middle class, people who paid hard-earned money to attend public concerts. And this time period boasted several famous virtuoso performer composers. We talked about Franz Liszt before the break. Another great virtuoso performer and composer was violinist Niccolo Paganini. Paganini, who lived from 1792 to 1840, was such a stunning violin virtuoso that some began to wonder if he had made a deal with the devil to be as skilled as he was. He studied with influential teachers throughout his childhood who recognized and nurtured his talent. They stirred his passion for playing and composing. As a young man, he established a vigorous schedule for himself, sometimes practicing and composing for 15 hours a day. He lived the life of a virtuoso, touring Europe and wowing audiences through his performances. He dedicated himself tirelessly to the craft, and his abilities were further augmented because of his unusually long, flexible fingers, which allowed for more dexterous playing. Still today, Paganini is considered one of the greatest violinists who ever lived, and his violin compositions are considered some of the most complicated pieces ever composed for that instrument. We're going to listen to a composition of his for solo violin. This is Caprice No. 13 in B-flat, and it's from a set of 24 caprices that were written more like etudes. That is, each caprice was like an exercise or a demonstration of a particular skill set for the instrument. Here is the legendary Nathan Milstein from his recording, The Last Recital. Thank you. That was Nathan Milstein from his recording The Last Recital, performing a caprice by Niccolo Paganini, one of the great violin virtuosos of history. And today on Music for Life, we are exploring music for virtuosity, compositions intended to showcase the highest level of performance achievement for a particular instrument. A violin virtuoso of our day, one based right here in Oklahoma, is Kyle Dillingham. For our backstage banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music, I want to play a discussion I had with Kyle. I played a portion of this interview with him in a previous episode, but didn't have time to play it entirely. In that interview, he gave some interesting thoughts about virtuosity, what that meant for musicians years ago, and even mentions what he thinks Paganini's performances may have been like.
The idea of a virtuoso. We have a very homogenized image of a virtuoso these days. It's a very specific thing. It's somebody who's playing every note perfectly. The tone is even all the way across, and there's no flaws. And, you know, it comes by way of competitions to reach a standard and mm-hmm. studying with this professor and then going here. And I think that if you look back historically, virtuosos were, the idea of virtuosity was a different thing. They were often great improvisers. Mm-hmm. They were, I always imagined that the performances were much more apt to something going wrong, you right. know, a little bit more on the edge.
Right. It wasn't the recording culture.
Right. And I had somebody, I met this concert pianist one time that was in town touring, and he said, I saw this poster. I have this poster of, it was advertising a Paganini concert in England back, you know, early part of last century, and he said, it was interesting, it said, at the end of the concert, Paganini will be imitating sounds of different barnyard animals. And it made you think, what was his performance actually like? Was it what we try to emulate, or what we've tried to reproduce? And I think it's probably not. I'm thinking that his performance was sure fantastic and a master, but I wonder if it had an edge that doesn't exist these days so often. Yeah.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are exploring music for virtuosity, compositions intended to showcase the highest level of performance achievement for a particular instrument. We've been talking about virtuosity in the Romantic era, composers who were both virtuoso performers and whose compositions required virtuosity. In the later part of the Romantic era, which went well into the 20th century for some composers, we meet a composer by the name of Sergei Rachmaninoff, known for his great skill as a pianist, which was due in large part to his overly large hands, which could reach 12 white keys on a piano, from thumb to pinky. Most can reach about 8 or 9 and maybe 10. One of his most difficult pieces is a piano concerto. It's 3 movements, like most concerti, but lasts about 50 minutes total, which is a lot of music to memorize. It's a marathon of quick chords, massive stretches, and dizzyingly nimble fingerwork. I'm going to play you just a portion of the 3rd movement. I'm going to start it close to where I think the hardest passage is, one of those lightning-quick passages. This is Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3, performed by pianist, again, Yevgeny Kissin, and this is Seiji Ozawa conducting the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you.
That was pianist Yevgeny Kissin performing with Seiji Ozawa and the Boston Symphony Orchestra the end of the third movement of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3. And it was an example of one of the hardest piano concertos written in the Romantic era. One of the hardest violin concertos was written by another Romantic and Russian composer, Peter Tchaikovsky. In fact, it was considered unplayable in places by a violinist of Tchaikovsky's day. Tchaikovsky wrote the piece in less than a month. He showed it to violinist Leopold Auer, who declared that the piece was too long and that some passages in the first and third movements were unplayable. 3 years later, violinist Adolf Brodsky mastered the entire work and premiered it in Vienna. But then even a music critic there wondered whether it is at all possible to extract a pure sound out of these hair-raising acrobatics, I do not know. But nowadays, this work is considered one of the great pieces of the standard violin repertoire, and in spite of its technical demands, it's quite playable. It's used in many a college audition these days. Here's the third and final movement of this amazing, virtuosic piece. This is violinist Yasha Heifetz performing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Fritz Reiner conducting. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are exploring music for virtuosity, compositions that were intended to showcase the highest level of performance achievement for any instrument. And that was Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto. That was the third movement. Yasha Heifetz was the soloist with Fritz Reiner and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It was a piece from the Romantic era. It was so difficult in places that the violinist for whom Tchaikovsky intended to perform it said it was too long and unplayable in places. Now it's commonly performed by the world's best violinists and even by prodigy high school students wanting a good college scholarship. As we move out of the Romantic era, let's explore a piece from early 20th century France. In 1908, Maurice Ravel wrote a set of three pieces for solo piano entitled Gaspard de la Nuit, with the express intent of writing a piano piece harder than Islamé, a notoriously difficult piano piece by the Russian composer Mili Balakirev. By way of comparison, Islamé contains passages which the composer said, the composer was considered a piano virtuoso, the composer said he couldn't even manage. But pianists generally agree that Ravel succeeded in topping Islamé's difficulty, some calling the three-movement suite a triathlon of sorts for the pianist. The final movement, titled Scarbo, might be considered the most technically challenging solo piano movement ever written, known for its nightmarish complexity, strange rhythms, and fast-repeated notes. Here is Moon Jung Kim performing the Scarbo movement from Maurice Ravel's Gaspard de la Nuit. That was Scarbo, the third and final movement of Gaspard de la Nuit, a suite by Maurice Ravel, and that was performed by Moon Jung Kim. And it's an example of one of the hardest instrumental pieces ever written, requiring virtuosity from the performer. And that was an example from the 20th century. Let's hear one more example from this time period. We've been listening to mostly piano and violin music in our discussion of virtuosity, but the first example we talked about today, from the Baroque era, was a vocal example. So let's bookend this discussion with a virtuosic vocal work from the 20th century. This is a soprano aria from Igor Stravinsky's opera, The Rake's Progress. Now, of course, many operatic roles are quite virtuosic. When it comes to soprano literature, this is quite common. This is also the case throughout music history. And perhaps there are other roles that are arguably more virtuosic than this one. Lucia, Violetta, Queen of the Night, which we played in a previous episode. Not to mention the totality of all of Bach's cantata arias, which demand a lot of skill from the singer. But Stravinsky requires the same high level of skill, and it is complicated even more by his use of atonality, a harmonic system that is particularly challenging for the human voice, and his use of multimeter, which means a constant shifting or changing of the beat pattern throughout the piece. So here is I Go to Him from The Rake's Progress by Igor Stravinsky. It is sung here by Jane West with the Orchestra of St. Luke's, Robert Kraft conducting. That was Jane West singing I Go to Him from Stravinsky's The Rake's Progress. And if you thought that was impressive, here's a reprise of that aria that comes back in Act 3 as a quartet. It's about 45 seconds. Here it is.
If you want, 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 if you
are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are exploring music for virtuosity. But how does a performer become a virtuoso? How does one achieve greatness on an instrument? For that, let's move into our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. You probably know the famous joke about the man asking directions in New York City, and he asks someone, "How do you get to Carnegie Hall?" And the local says, "Practice, practice, practice." Well, to achieve virtuosity or a high level of skill, or what we might call greatness, on an instrument, it requires that one thing of the music student: practice. But not just any kind of practice. There's a phrase that goes like this: practice does not make perfect, perfect practice makes perfect. This kind of practice was well defined in Jeff Colvin's book, Talent is Overrated. In that book, he calls perfect practice deliberate practice. So let's talk a little about that for our Classroom Corner segment today. This shows what kind of work we parents should expect from our young music students. And we'll also hear in this segment from world-renowned violinist Joshua Bell on this subject, from a talk he gave here at Armstrong Auditorium recently. All the research and supporting evidence from human history shows that superior achievement or virtuosity comes from hours and hours of deliberate practice. That means the greats put in a set number of hours in their particular field. Some call it the 10,000 hours principle. It's not exactly 10,000 hours. It's a round number. Greatness or virtuosity in any field requires about that much practice. If you were to practice for 3 hours a day, 6 days a week, it would take you nearly 11 years to get to 10,000 hours. But it's more than just quantity of hours. The time of day those hours are put in can actually separate the average from the great. And most importantly, how those hours are spent is critical. Colvin writes, "Deliberate practice is not what most of us do when we think we're practicing golf or the oboe or any of our other interests." He says, "It is hard, it hurts, but it works. More of it equals better performance, tons of it equals great performance." Such practice requires intense mental concentration along with physical effort. So what is deliberate practice? According to Colvin, part of it is pushing yourself just beyond your comfort zone. Colvin refers to University of Michigan professor Noel Tishy's three concentric circles, with one being the comfort zone, the next one out being the learning zone, and the outer one the panic zone. If we do what only comes easily to us, the comfort zone, we will never get better. But if we give ourselves too difficult a task, we freeze in the panic zone. Teachers can easily recognize when they've thrust the child into that zone, and they know how to bring the child back to the learning zone, where the tasks are just difficult enough to stretch the student, but not so difficult as to cause the student to lock up. But here are some more specifics on what deliberate practice is. Deliberate practice, as advocated by the best music educators, is high repetition of the right way to perform any task. Colvin says, quote, "Repeating a specific activity over and over is what most of us mean by practice, yet for most of us it isn't especially effective," unquote. So just repeating an activity over and over doesn't necessarily mean we are practicing it. We must know what to repeat, which leads to another aspect of deliberate practice. It's designed practice. Colvin says, quote, "The great performers isolate remarkably specific aspects of what they do and focus on just those things until they are improved. Then it's on to the next aspect," unquote. We'll hear Joshua Bell talk about that. To know what those aspects are requires coaching, someone who has been at the field longer and knows the most efficient and effective pathway to success. Parents should observe lessons or coaching sessions so they can reinforce the teaching methods later in the absence of that coach or teacher. Deliberate practice also requires continuous feedback on whether the task is being performed properly. Colvin quotes Steve Kerr, former chief learning officer of Goldman Sachs, who said that practicing without feedback is like bowling through a curtain that hangs down to knee level. This is also where the coach, teacher, and parent are critical. We need feedback to ensure we are, in fact, getting better. Deliberate practice is highly demanding mentally. The mental requirements of deliberate practice are the main reason most people are not great at certain tasks. The concentration necessary to repeat that small 16th note passage dozens or hundreds of times, or to condition the brain to move the finger in that way every time, is largely what separates the average performer from the virtuoso. Deliberate practice is, in fact, not much fun of itself. If it were inherently fun and easy work, everyone would do it, and everyone would be great. This is why in the field of music education, parental involvement is a key element. Also, praise and encouragement are important to help a child stick with a challenging activity. Again, it's not fun of itself, but the results are fun. If your child lacks self-motivation, don't worry. It doesn't mean they are doomed to mediocrity. It means they're human. But praise, encouragement, and parental motivation can help a child conquer his or her lazy tendencies. Evidence shows that in many cases, eventually children will internalize or take on that motivation themselves. One study looked at the 24 finalists of the prestigious Van Cliburn Piano Competition. Not all were child prodigies. They were forced to practice, just like everyone else. One of them being forced even to age 15, he said. Colvin relates, quote, "One of the pianists recalled the life-changing experience at age 15 of sitting just 3 feet away as a great pianist performed." And then Colvin quotes this pianist, "I remember feeling inundated and overwhelmed with the dynamic range, with the expressive potential. At that point, I became serious like I never had before. I cut out horsing around at the piano. I worked," unquote. For more on this idea of deliberate practice, let's hear from one of the greatest virtuosi of our day, violinist Joshua Bell. He spoke about practice habits at an assembly in Armstrong Auditorium just hours before his October 22nd recital in the same venue.
No, I don't think there's a magic number of 10,000 hours suddenly. I think 9,000 is good, 11,000 is better. And certainly it takes a lot of practice, but it's you know, I've noticed when I was in school, in college, I mean, there were some people that got away with practicing less and just had some innate ability to be able to get away with less, but they still needed to practice. Others I saw that didn't have quite the same innate ability, but they put a lot of time in it and they became very, very successful. So it takes both practice and I've also seen people with incredible talent throw it away by not working at all. So it's obviously both things. I definitely work quite a bit, but I've never been one that felt the need to practice or the desire to practice, you know, 10 hours a day and lock myself in a room. As a kid, I was into a lot of other things. You know, I was into sports. I was into, you know, school and even video games as a teenager, you know, things like that. And my parents did not expect me to become a professional musician, at least not until I got to be a teenager where I knew myself that I really wanted to do that. So I was juggling a lot of things. I'm sure a lot of you have your homework and have your other interests, and it's hard to find time to practice. So for me, it's always been about quality of time rather than amount of time. I think a practice session should be sort of thought out a little bit ahead of time. Before you practice, kind of think, what would you like to achieve? You know, whether it's a new piece of music, whether you want to learn from here to here, or one page, learn it really well, or there are like some parts of the piece that you've never been able to do well, and you just say, you know what, today I'm going to really figure this out, and I'm going to get this one passage that I can never get right. I'm just going to do this 100 times in a row until I can do it 10 times in a row without making a mistake, you know. And then if, at the end of a practice session, if you feel you've accomplished something, that's a good practice session. Not just playing through all your pieces, you know, you've got a bunch of pieces and you just play through them. Okay, I did this, and I'm done. I did my, you know, that's there's a recognition there, which I've been, you know, I was guilty of that kind of thing as well. You want to do the things that actually, sometimes we want to practice the things that we do well first, and that's because it's more fun to play things we know we do well, when in fact you're supposed to be, the things that are harder are the things that you need to spend more time on. So finding, you know, getting quality time and really spending a very concentrated time, you know, even if it's not hours and hours, I think is really important. And as far as what you do when you're practicing, for me, slow practice is so important. Practicing whatever your piece is slowly and being able to control whatever that is. If it's a very technical piece, to be able to do it at all tempos, not just, because when you get nervous, you time has gets distorted. I don't know if Einstein actually thought about it in terms of performing the relativity of time, but when you get nervous, your whole sense of time changes. You start rushing, as you know. You start, especially, you know, if you're playing with a pianist, let's say you're an accompanist that's not quite as nervous as you are, it will feel like they're just dragging all the time. And when you're going faster, when you start going faster, at the proper tempo feels strange and feels slow, and you can get tripped up because you're not used to practice playing things slower than what you feel. So if you really practice at all tempos very slowly, sometimes what I like to do is use a metronome. I think metronomes are very good for practicing, not all the time, but sometimes also for showing you where your rhythm is bad and where you're rushing. I often play with a metronome just to kind of see where I am with rhythm, where my tendencies are. But start at a low, you know, low metronome marking, and then play it until you can do it well, and then just edge it up a notch and keep going up a notch, and you kind of before you know it, you're doing it at the proper tempo. So scales are great because it's very clean, you know, and the scales don't involve all the emotional side of things. It lets you concentrate on just the technical side of what you're doing. And when you're doing a scale, you can work on your sound. Just, you know, something as simple as just your bow changes, you know, just concentrate on something like that. Like I do that sometimes. I just think, you know, I'm just going to go through a scale and concentrate on making smooth bow changes, or intonation, of course. But so scales are very, very useful, and because they pop up in music all the time. If you play a Beethoven violin concerto, it's basically scales up and down, but just arranged in a very, very beautiful way. And when you've practiced scales, it makes everything easier. So I can't say I was one of the best at it, but as far as taking the time, enough time, scales, I probably could have used more. Some of the greatest violinists, like Heifetz, for instance, my idol, he was such an advocate of scales, and he had the most incredible technique. So it's obviously did well for him. There were horror stories of people coming to play for Heifetz, you know, and they came prepared with all their pieces. And he says, I don't want to hear it. I want you to play a G-sharp minor scale, four octaves, and then in thirds. And they had no idea what to do. And he kicked them out and said, I'm not teaching you, goodbye. You know, like, you know, because he believed so strongly in that and in scales. So anyway, that's just some practice things I do. And also always playing around with trying to figure out really, really critical listening to yourself. Like, I've seen people practice and young people practice where they put up with a bad sound, you know, a sound that squeaks and things, and they just keep going instead of saying, wait, why did it sound bad? I'm going to figure this out. It's always for a reason. It's either your bow is going too fast or too slow and compared to the pressure of the bow, or you have to figure out all these things yourself, you know, what works. And if it doesn't sound good, fix it and experiment. You know, what's going to make it sound? Try a faster bow. Try pressing more. If you do too fast a bow, it'll start whistling. If you do too hard, it's going to start crunching. You know, that's why the string instruments is so hard to get. The piano is easy. You just press the note, and it's like typing. It's like, I'm joking.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are exploring music for virtuosity, compositions intended to showcase the highest level of performance achievement for a particular instrument. That was a portion of a discussion we had with Joshua Bell on our Armstrong Auditorium stage just before his October 22nd performance here at Armstrong. He was talking about practice habits and the kind of practice necessary to become a virtuoso. Finally, let's have our dessert for today, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program. Virtuosity is not just confined to classical or fine art music. There is a great deal of virtuosity in the jazz tradition, with performers like Art Tatum and Oscar Peterson. Virtuosity is also found in many folk traditions, particularly in the style of bluegrass. So to end today's program on virtuosity, let's hear a song performed by Alison Krauss and Union Station. Here is Sawin' on the Strings.
Hills. There used to live a mountaineer they called him.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.